The single most powerful threat to our world might surprise you. It's not violence or corruption, or even a tangible object. What if the most powerful threat to our world is a tiny voice? A tiny voice inside your head that says, you can't make a difference. You can't change the world. Paralyzing you with doubt and preventing you from living and loving in the most powerful way possible. If you have heard this voice, you're not alone. Highland Park United Methodist Church is comprised of thousands of people just like you. And for over 100 years, HPMC has helped people to conquer that sense of doubt and replace it with bold conviction and sacred assurance. HPMC wants you to experience new life, a life beyond anything you can imagine, a life beyond your walls, beyond yourself, and beyond your limits.
This morning we continue with the Beyond theme as we talk about living life beyond ourselves. Sydney and I have, maybe the word is lapsed into sort of a ritual on Saturday mornings when we can take our time and not have to get up early and go off somewhere. We find ourselves reading our respective iPads, and when we run across something we like, we share it with the other who is kind enough to stop reading and actually be interested and listen to what the other person is reading to them. And yesterday she read to me an obituary of a man who passed away on January the 30th in Galveston, Texas. And I said to her, send that to me. I think that's instructional. So I'm going to share it with you. The gentleman's name was Leslie Ray Charping. He died at the age of 75, and his family placed this obituary in the paper. If you've had that experience of and know what it costs to put an obituary in the paper nowadays, you know that this was no considerable expense, that they didn't spare in putting this in the paper. It said that the family wrote that he left behind two relieved children and countless other victims, including an ex-wife, relatives, friends, neighbors, doctors, nurses, and random strangers. They said his death came at an age that was 29 years longer than expected and much longer than he deserved. They said at a young age, Leslie quickly became a model example of bad parenting combined with mental illness and a complete commitment to drinking, drugs, womanizing, and being generally offensive. The obituary went on to list his hobbies, which included abusing his family, expediting trips to heaven for his pets. He was also interested in fishing, which, quote, he was less skilled with than the previously mentioned, unquote. Leslie's life served no other obvious purpose. He did not contribute to society or serve his community, and he possessed no redeeming qualities besides quick-witted sarcasm, which was amusing during his sober days. No funeral service was held for him, and I think that's the saddest part of the whole thing. They concluded by saying Leslie's passing proves that evil does in fact die, and hopefully marks a time of healing and safety for all. Cursed to be a curse. We're all familiar with that vicious cycle, aren't we? People who seem to have been dealt a difficult hand and somehow they're not able to overcome, so they pass it on. And they take their afflictions and they afflict others with that. The scriptures tell us and talk to us about a different type of cycle. We turn to the book of Genesis and we note that the initial cycle and the great stories of our faith are what are known as the Deuteronomic formula. I like to think of it as a sequence. And the sequence goes like this. God initiates a covenant, such as God did with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Implicit in the very act of creation is a covenant. I am your creator, and so you must be obedient to me. And so all that I ask in our covenant is that you abide by my rules. And all I'm asking in order for you to enjoy paradise is do not eat of the fruit of the tree. Is that understood? Yeah, we got it. But it just proved to be too tempting, didn't it? With a little help from the serpent. And so Adam and Eve partake of that. And so there is a breach of the covenant. Then there is a judgment. There is punishment. And then the punishment is followed by reconciliation, in which the Deuteronomic sequence begins again, in which God takes the initiative and forgives them and bestows additional blessings on them. This continues through the flood. until you get to the Tower of Babel. And then it seems to be incomplete, in that you have, they're building the ziggurat into the heavens. They have no respect or regard for the Creator God in their lives or in that endeavor. And so God confuses their language. There is the punishment. And so you're waiting because you're used to that cycle. You're waiting for the reconciliation and it doesn't come. You simply turn the page and what do you get? A genealogy that ends in a man named Abram. And God takes the initiative, and I want you to hear what God does in our scripture. God takes the initiative and makes this pronouncement. If you want to follow along in your bulletins, Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." May the Lord bless the reading of this word. It is, in fact, the central theme of the Bible. The notion that we have been promised by a loving God the promised land. And so we seek that earnestly. We are on a quest through all the prophets. And then found definitively in the life of Jesus Christ, we have this promise that we embrace, not just in the hereafter, but in this life as well. We embrace it, we seek it, we hunger for it. So we have this notion of blessing. We are blessed, not just so that we can go around and say, well, I'm blessed, I'm kind of fortunate. God must love me just a little bit more than God loves you. But blessed for a purpose. God has an ulterior motive. We are blessed so that we in turn can be a blessing. And we know from the parable of the unjust steward who was forgiven a gazillion dollars debt by the king that when we go out and do not pass it on, bad things happen because that gentleman was thrown into prison. So what is the nature of blessings? If we're honest and we take the time and all of our busyness, we can inventory our blessings and we realize that we have much. There is abundance all around us. A lot of that is hereditary. We are given blessings by virtue of our parents. We have certain characteristics in the genetic, helixes, as they break down the chromosomes, we have characteristics. It's the very definition of determinism, isn't it? You're dealt a hand. That's determinism. How you play it, that's human will. What you do with it. So we have many blessings. We have God-given skills. In the book, To Kill a Mockingbird, there's a scene that I remember in it. It was in the book and the movie. In the movie, you can see Gregory Peck playing Atticus Finch. And the sheriff lets him know there's a rabid dog that comes into town and it's lurching and it's got the hydrophobia and all that stuff and it needs to be put down before it bites somebody. So the sheriff, they pull up Atticus and the sheriff and they see this dog lurching down the main street and the sheriff says, "You better take it, Mr. Finch. I'm not that good a shot." And with Jim, little son Jim, looking on, Atticus Finch puts aside his glasses and he shoots the dog with one shot about 100 yards away and the thing just keels over. And the sheriff runs up and he says, "Right between the eyes." And Jim is just like, he's just astounded. He never even knew that his father had even shot a rifle before. And the sheriff, noting his expression, says, "Well, son, didn't you know that your father is the best shot in the county?" And the moral of the story is that which we are, our skills, our God-given skills, are not things that we should brag about. Because really they have little to do with our own doing, you know. It's just something that's been given to us. The same with property and wealth. Some people are born into wealth that is being passed on from a family. And how you contend with that will say a lot about you. Some are good stewards of it and take on and are mindful of the hard work and the labor and the responsibility that goes with being a person or a family of means. Others squander it. Others see it as an invitation to go out and subscribe to jet set living. Others embrace the Epicurean notion that you only go around once in life, so you might as well grab for all the gusto. The more and the more expensive, the better. And sometimes they squander it away. I like the poem written by Carl Sandburg entitled, Get Off This Estate. Get off this estate. What for? It's a dialogue. What for? Because it's mine. Well, where did you get it? From my father. Where did he get it? From his father. Well, where did he get it? He fought for it. Okay. Well, I'll fight you for it. You see how those things can change. So we have that which we've been given, and we need to be humble about that. It's not nothing to brag about. We need to be good stewards of our characteristics, our gifts, and property and wealth. And then there is those people who are self-made. And I've got a real sympathy for self-made people, you know, because it's hard. It's not easy to do it yourself. People who work three jobs to put themselves through college and got that college degree and went out and made something of themselves. You know, I can identify with the older son and the prodigal son. You know, I was the oldest son in my family of six, you know, I watched as my parents were in a position to really sort of baby the younger siblings. And I found myself coming home from college going, really? I mean, are you kidding me? I mean, you never said that to me. I was never allowed. No chores at all. Come on now. I don't mind taking movies of the baseball games, but you're filming his practices. Are you kidding me? Come on now. So I get that, you know, and I also get the understanding that, you know, you go, I did it myself, I worked hard, and so consequently, I've been rewarded. These are the fruits of my labors. The challenge is, we have to answer the question, how much is enough? Sometimes we're so busy, we never get around to answering that question, you know? Sometimes you've seen families that break apart because they were so busy accumulating, they never got around to giving each other affection or giving the children attention. And so you see one spouse or the other saying, well, I gave it all for you. All that travel, all that work, all the overtime, the 80 hours a week at the office, the billable hours, I was doing it for you. And the sad answer always is, well, we never asked you to. We just wanted you. Just wanted to be around you. So we realize there's a fail in the Epicurean notion as you climb the Maslow pyramid of needs. How much is enough, you know? I remember watching one of those 2020 documentaries, and they're talking about the new size of people's homes. And how in the world did the Woodstock generation go around to build these monster houses? It's as if we all went home to our family trees and said, oh my gosh, I've got aristocracy in my family. We've got to build a castle. We didn't want to, but we're required to do that. So they went to a couple in Houston that had built like a 60,000 square foot home, you know, and they'd lived in it for a year. And so the expected cautionary tale was that they were going to interview them and say, okay, you've been in it a year. Now, having lived in the house a year, is there anything that you would do differently as you rattle around in this 60,000 square foot home? And the husband said, yeah, there was. We'd build an additional room for our shoes. Need that additional room for the shoes. So sometimes we try to satiate our needs. And the paradox of humanity is they never end. It's an endless cycle of needs that we synthesize and tell ourselves that we need, but we're never really happy. We don't find fulfillment in that. And consequently, the paradox that we're lifting up and that was inherent in the scripture is God says to Abram, you are blessed to be a blessing. Not blessed to hoard or accumulate, but you're blessed to go out and be a blessing. And the paradox is the more that we do that and embrace that notion and go out and we bless others, the more fulfilled that we will be. It's a paradox. Paul was referencing a scientific study, which he said, you know, it actually releases oxytocin, which is this hormone inside of you. When you do for others and you get affirmed, it releases a chemical in your body and you feel good. And you should feel good because you're making a difference. And so we encourage you to go out and volunteer. If you really want to be fulfilled, live a balanced life. Don't be one of those people that's on so many boards and you're so eaten up with community service that you're neglecting the people around you. That's one extreme. The other extreme is somebody who does nothing for anybody else, and you get these kind of obituaries written about you after the fact. Somewhere between those two extremes, there is an optimum that would work for you. My admonition to you this morning is find it. Be blessed. Count your blessings. And then know that you are blessed to be a blessing. That applies to organizational behavior as well. We move into this capital campaign and we talk about our theme is beyond. We're talking about being beyond ourselves. The great thing about this capital campaign, let's be honest, most churches, when they do a capital campaign, it's solely to raise money for brick and mortar. And bless their hearts, that's about all they can do. They're lucky if they can raise enough money to build the new building or the Family Life Center. This church is different. We are very blessed in that we have a goal of a phenomenal amount of money, $65 million, but over one-third of that is to go for mission and outreach and moving beyond ourselves. And that's pretty exciting. One of the initiatives that we're doing, we'll talk about missions next Sunday. One of the initiatives we're doing is the Mark Craig Leadership Initiative, Leadership Institute, rather. I can tell you a personal experience I had with Mark. Mark and I were friends. We're both Central Texas Conference boys. We crossed the river to come over, and we were transferred over here to Dallas. And I was at a district meeting, and we were at the chapel of Duncanville, First Methodist Duncanville, and Mark and I were sharing a hymnal. And while we're singing, and Mark wasn't big on singing, he was just kind of mouthing the words, but we look across, and in the pew in front of us is a young man who's earnestly singing the hymn and looking forward, and he points him out to me and says, "That guy's name is Paul Rasmussen. I have him doing our contemporary service. He's now outdrawing me in attendance." And I got to tell you, in most churches, the senior minister would say, "He's outdrawing me, so I will get rid of him next week." That's a real problem. That's not going to happen. We're not going to allow that. Mark said it with a note of pride, almost fatherly pride, as a mentor. And that's very unique in Mark's DNA and in the DNA of this church. That it's not about you or your ego or building your legacy or building your monument. It's about serving the church and moving beyond yourself to make a difference. And Mark did that as he mentored Paul. And so it's fitting that we would name the Leadership Institute after Mark Craig, and it's fitting that it would be made possible by a very generous lead gift of $1 million. I won't embarrass the person who is within the proximity of my voice by giving their name, but I'll say that they were very generous in making this possible as we not only honor Mark, but we move into the future. We anticipate that we'll have a speaker series. Let me tell you a little cautionary tale. Paul came to me and said, "Would you take on the leadership, this leadership theme, this goal?" And I said, "Okay." I had a few other things going on, but I decided I would boldly move into it. So we brought in a speaker, and I put on a program. I learned how you reserve a space in this church, and we brought in an author to talk about leadership. And, you know, we didn't publicize it in the community. We had about 60 or 70 people there, and I was disappointed in the attendance. I thought, gosh, with all everything around her seems to boom, and I do a little speaker series, and the first one, we get about 70 people, you know. So I was a little disappointed, but come to find out that sitting at our head table talking to this author who talks about how businesses should be ethical and run their businesses is a CEO, a member of our church, CEO of a major corporation who struck up a conversation with the author, and then in turn it changed their whole outlook and they went out and started a whole new program at their Fortune 500 company. Why? Because they came to our little book review here under the roof of Highland Park United Methodist Church. That's the type of thing that happens at this church. Well, we want to build on that. We want to bring in more speakers and bring them in. And not only that, but when we have a large event, don't just wave goodbye to the people and give them a copy of the book, but have them sign up for small groups and have a curriculum as we talk about leadership and move into the workplace and move the notion of Christian ethics into the workplace. So we'll have a speaker series. Also, we're going to have a residency program in which we claim the great leadership that's going on at this church, and we say we think we can teach others how to do the same. We want to continue and extend the mentoring that Mark was about. And so we want to bring people in. My daughter, who's a doctor, did her residency at Baylor Hospital. 1 month she was in surgery, the next in ER, the next she was doing pediatrics. We want to do the same type of thing. Have young men and women to come, and they'll be in congregational care 1 month, and the next they'll be over in program or Christian education, or we'll talk to them about preaching and hopefully pass on that DNA, the way that this church has a particular knack for making things happen. So that's one thing, the Mark Craig Leadership Institute. The other is all about continuing the tradition of starting new churches. And at this time, I want you to take a look at this video regarding planting new churches.
We've always liked the word church planting because to me it really is descriptive of what we're doing. It's planting or the birth of a new child that you have to nurture it in the first years and then you watch it grow and then eventually it takes on its own personality and ministries and outreach. When you find a church that has matured and can have as many outreach programs as Highland Park, you look at their work in the inner city, the building of homes for Habitat, the ministering to families with special needs, you reach a certain point where you are blessed and it's your responsibility to reach out and help others. And once you have that, the amount of impact that you can have on the city is tremendous. Now, in helping church plants over the years, I've learned that sometimes it's not successful. If you try to be something that the community isn't, you're not accepted. Highland Park recreated in Munger, I don't think would enjoy the same success as it has as its own personality. Just like when I look at the Grove, I see it as a whole new opportunity to create another personality that is not just a Highland Park campus, but it's its own ministry and outreach and touches the neighbors in different ways than we might hear. We look at it that when the church grows and matures, it's their responsibility to foster that growth. I see the role being, we're not building a building, but we're building a ministry that hopefully is blessed and will continue to grow. And if it does, then it can build the next church and the following church. And that's the growth that we're looking for.
40 churches, that's a lot. We're going to continue that tradition with one little twist in the model. It used to be that we would start a church and then spin it off and it would become its own entity. Now Mama's holding on to them. We're claiming they're a part of the Highland Park United Methodist Church umbrella. And just like Munger is a part of our church, and we don't intend on spinning it off, we're now taking over what was the Schreiber Memorial United Methodist Church over in Northwest Dallas. I believe it's near Midway, and it's west of the tollway near Forest. And we're going to revitalize that church. It's going to be known as The Grove at Schreiber Manor. Stephen Lohofer is going to be the campus pastor, and he's very talented and dynamic, and we're sending him out there. We're going to do some renovation. We're going to invest and capitalize in this church. Our goal is to start three new churches in the next 5 years. They cost about $3 million each to do that, and a lot of elbow grease, a lot of sweat equity, but we think we can do that and get another vibrant church going. Munger Place, which was started, about 5 or 6 years ago, here in East Dallas, is now the fastest growing Methodist church in the nation. You did that. This congregation did that, and we can continue to do that with your support. The Grove is right next to W.T. White High School. There's 3,000 students, 90% of whom are considered to be at risk or to be disadvantaged. And that will be a major focus of their ministry, to take the gospel of Jesus Christ and to make a difference in those young people's lives and to, as Stephen says, change their trajectory. And the main way to do that is to provide an adult presence and mentorship in their lives. So many of them are missing that. We can do that through the Grove. Your support of the campaign will help make that possible. So there's two major initiatives there. Now let me get concrete with you and talk to you about the expectations and how you can participate in this campaign. Sometimes when people don't exactly understand how to get involved, they can get their feelings hurt. I'm reminded of a story, a small Methodist church out in the country. The church secretary gets a phone call, and the guy on the other end says, may I speak to the head hog at the trough? And the secretary goes, excuse me? He goes, yeah, the head hog at the trough. May I speak to him, please? She says, sir, if you're referring to our senior minister, Dr. Miller, we do not refer to him in that way. He said, well, ma'am, I'm very sorry. I didn't mean to cause any harm, and maybe I should just get off the phone and call another church or charity. You see, we've had I had a bumper crop of soybeans, and I just felt generous and wanted to give $50,000 to maybe help out your ministry. And the secretary goes, can you hold on a second? The big pig just pulled up. Let me get you, we want to make sure that everybody understands how to get involved. And I don't want to insult your intelligence, but they say keep it simple, stupid. So like I teach the five components of prayer at Vacation Bible School. If you just hold up your hand, there's really five components to this. Number one, understand, get the information you need. Hopefully you've received a brochure in the mail. If you need more information, if you're specifically interested in one ministry as opposed to other, get the information you need. Let us work for you. We're here to provide you with the information. So that's number one. Number two, give some prayerful consideration to what extent you can get involved in this campaign. And let's be honest, we're talking about second mile giving here. We're going to continue our annual ministry, so we're presupposing, and we don't want to be audacious about it, but we're saying we're talking about over and beyond, let's use that word beyond, your annual giving. We're talking about what can you give over and beyond in second mile giving. The consultants will tell you, I always love to hear them say it, that you know the annual giving is out of the first pocket. That's out of your annual, your monthly salary. The capital giving is out of that second pocket, your stock portfolios and your treasury bonds and things like that. Sydney and I have never really had a second pocket. So we just sort of continue to give a little bit more out of our first pocket or out of the salary that we would have. But you give prayerful consideration. Somewhere between giving it all away and leaving yourself destitute at one extreme and the other extreme doing nothing, there is a point that works for you that would help you to be able to say, yes, we are also participating in sacrificial giving in order to help our church move beyond and embrace this great vision. Then once you know that, number three, fill out the pledge card. It always comes down to a pledge card, doesn't it? It's just a piece of cardboard, you write down a hieroglyphic, and you sign it. It's not a blood oath, it's an estimate of giving. It's understood that sometimes circumstances change. We always tend to think, well, what if something awful happens? Well, of course, we're not gonna send some guy with brass knuckles to your house to get the money out of you. You know, we understand. Nobody ever thinks of the other way. It's happened a few times. People said, I've unexpectedly have come into a lot of money. I need to increase my pledge. So make your pledge, sign it. Number four, either mail it in the envelope that's provided, or number five, bring it with you on Sunday in 2 weeks, Sunday, February the 26th. And we're going to have a ritual of commitment during that Sunday that will involve everybody. A lot of people have already turned their cards in. And so, well, we want to make it possible for everybody to feel that we are one and we'll do something all together. It's going to be very neat and very affirming. And that's going to conclude the campaign. I've been working on, and Paula, we've been working on this campaign for over 2.5 years. The public phase is lasting 1 month. So please, I don't want to be down at the grocery store and hear a Highland Park member say, if they talk about money one more time, I'm just not going to be able to go back to that place. Because it's really only lasted 1 month. So if you'll get it in, then we can move into Lent and get excited and move towards Easter. Be very exciting. So hopefully that's explanatory. That's what's going on. And, you know, as they say, if absence does indeed make the heart grow fonder, then faith in Christ certainly must move us beyonder. Amen. And now, if you'll please stand, let us sing our closing hymn together.